Welcome. You're listening to the Mac Observer's Background Mode. This is your host, John Martellaro. And this week, my guest is science communicator, Dr. Kiki Sanford. Kiki, welcome to the show again.
Thank you. It is great to be back with you again.
We had such a great show back in November. There was so much stuff we didn't get a chance to talk about. So I was planning on inviting you back, and here we are. Thank you.
You're welcome. Yeah, I'm looking forward to our conversation.
So for the listeners, just as an introduction, Dr. Sanford is a PhD scientist, experienced science communicator, and founder of This Week in Science. What is that? Let me quote from the intro. This Week in Science is a weekly, hour-long web and radio show presenting a humorous, often opinionated, and irreverent look at the week in science and technology. Each episode of This Week in Science discusses the latest in cutting-edge science news, topics such as genetic engineering, stem cells, cybernetics, epigenetics, which I've never heard of. I want to ask you about that in a minute.
All right.
Space exploration, neuroscience, microbiology, the end of the world, and his show favorite, Countdown to World Robot Domination. This is a subject also near and dear to my heart because I write endlessly about robots and AI at the Mac Observer. So that's the stuff that you guys covered this week in science. And we're going to get into some of those technical subjects in the latter half of the show. But for those listeners who may have missed the original show in November, I thought we'd just take a few minutes to get a recap on your career, because that's what Background Mode is all about, is how distinguished technical people came to be where they are. So take us back and give us a brief introduction about how you were thinking when you were younger and as your career evolved towards college.
Well, when I was young, you know, I was the typical high school, you know, I don't know, I was always curious. And I think we talked about that before, about being curious and having parents that allowed me to be curious about things. But I had no idea what I wanted to do. I was all over the place. I mean, I remember my junior year in high school, I had more arts classes than I did science classes. I had taken an anatomy and physiology course over the summer and kind of gotten this science class out of the way. And so I spent the year taking band. I played clarinet and choir. I loved to sing. I did drama. I did yearbook. I did everything except the really technical stuff that year.
Sounds like great preparation for being a science communicator, though.
Exactly.
So balanced. Yeah.
Yeah. So over time, everything has kind of fallen into place as now that I look back on my life, I go, of course, This is what I should have been doing from the beginning, but I didn't know that. And so I got into University of California, Davis, as an undeclared freshman, which meant I didn't know what I was doing. And I just started taking science classes.
Did that annoy your parents?
Oh, yeah. To no end. What are you going to do with your life?
Right.
You know? My dad wanted me to become a doctor or a lawyer, you know, the proper careers that you take, you know. And I wasn't quite sure about that. I was young and idealistic, and I had visions of working with Greenpeace and trying to save the whales, and I had lots of ideas. And then as I went through university, I did focus in on wildlife and ecology as my interest area, and I ended up getting a Bachelor of Science in wildlife and conservation ecology. And from there, I got into birds, and I loved the idea of working with birds. So
that's what fascinated me in the first show. We got into discussion
of that.
I was really turned on. I was ready to drop everything and become a research ornithologist or whatever, because bird navigation always interested me. Anyway, sideline.
Yeah, I did that. I got a PhD in molecular, cellular, and integrative physiology, again, from UC Davis. And the basic gist of my PhD research was bird brains. I got a PhD in bird brains. And
that's cooler than you say, because Because as I assume you're getting ready to describe it, you researched how they memorize things, right?
Right. So I was interested in a particular area of the brain called the hippocampus, which in mammals as well as birds and other species, other families, it is important for learning and memory. And it is also important for navigation. And so this area of the brain I thought was just wonderful and interesting. And in birds, it's right on top of the head. So it's really easy to access if you want to do neurological studies, neuroanatomical studies. So that's the kind of stuff I did. We messed around with the bird hippocampus and figured out how our messing around affected their ability to remember where they stored food.
Did that involve nutritional studies about which foods helped them better remember their navigation paths?
No, I didn't do anything like that. The first area I worked on involved looking at how hormones affect memory. So there's a body of evidence, you know, especially in women, that suggests that estrogen is important for memory formation, and that there's a decline in memory in the hippocampus as you get older and hit menopause. And so there was this whole direction of research we were going in to see how estrogen or blocking estrogen or adding testosterone affected birds' memory.
Cool.
For food places.
Cool.
Yeah.
But that was after you came to Earth from from Alderaan.
That's
I was reading
right.
Your bio. Your bio says you were stuck in a dead-end job on Alderaan as a space medic in charge of routine blood work in a MASH unit during the Clone Wars. Is that why you left Alderaan to come to Earth? I love that.
That's right. It was a bloody mess, and I was tired of it. It was time for a new challenge. I needed to start doing something new, and I found it in the bird brain.
And then we talked about in the previous show about how you came then to become a really great science communicator and launched This Week in Science. And so now we get to the real meat of the show, some of the things that you've been discussing on This Week in Science.
I want to go back to that intro. Yeah, we got to that. And so, I was doing This Week in Science. I was doing science communication in parallel to grad school, and it really was the thing that ended up really clicking and falling into place. And so I completed my degree thinking, okay, I'll get my PhD, be a scientist, and have credibility in the world of communicating science.
I had a previous guest on, Jennifer Ouellette, who's a science writer.
Yes.
The wife of a physicist.
She's wonderful. Yeah.
Yes, she is. And she told me the story about how she went to work for the APS doing writing. And I told her, we think it's easier to teach you, a smart writer, physics than it is to teach some of these physicists how to write. And she's a good example of that.
It depends on personalities and abilities and... You know, I think there is some truth to that, that if somebody is a very good writer and is focused on writing their entire career, they know how to tell a story. They know how to craft that tale in a way that's going to grasp the interest of a reader in a way that a scientist might not. However, a scientist has been studying things and has this curiosity to find out why things are. And so they understand that intrigue. From the get-go, they want to ask questions. And so if you can draw that out of a scientist and let them run with where their interest comes from, suddenly you can get a story out of a scientist. You can get a scientist to understand how to tell the tale. I think it goes both ways now, which is wonderful. There are many scientists turned science communicators, such as myself, and there are many writers turned science writers, Carl Zimmer, Jennifer Ouellette, many others that are amazing at telling a tale.
Do you remember James Burke and Connections?
Yeah, that's an old one. Yeah.
Boy, did he tell great stories. He was a great communicator. Yeah. Carl Sagan comes to mind.
Yes.
Neil deGrasse Tyson, great storytellers. And that's what gets people excited about science, I think, is that when you tell a story, you're weaving in the listener's or the viewer's mind with the intrigue and the mystery of science and how people discovered things. And suddenly, as you said a little while ago, people get curious. They go, oh, I want to find out more about that. But if you tell the story in a compelling way, it gets people wound up about what's going on with our world.
Absolutely.
It's really cool.
That's really the driving factor for me, is I find so much that's interesting in the world and I want to learn new things. And that was one of the aspects of being in a PhD and being a scientist. You drill down on one specific area of study and it's such a tiny area of the world. You know, you might be answering some great questions and getting to expand your creativity by designing experiments and troubleshooting and figuring out new ways to approach the questions. But you know, I found that I've just been so driven by wanting to know more. I want to know more about so many things. And then I want to share it with people. And I want other people to be as interested as I am. I want to find a way to be able to get other people to get excited about this stuff. And that's what kind of keeps me going. Okay, what are the questions? And then how can I really make this interesting to somebody? How can I get the story across?
I'm reading The Short History of Nearly Everything by Bill Bryson.
Oh, Bill Bryson. He's wonderful.
He's awesome. Yeah.
Yes. And that is a great, for anyone who hasn't read, or it's a good audio book as well. It's a great listen. If people haven't read that book, it is such a great introduction to so much of the sciences and some of the wonderful aspects of the history of science. There's some great stories in there between different scientists battling for, you know, for being the top scientist in a particular field at a particular time. And it's just, he tells the stories so well.
Yeah, so many eye openers in that book, because he talks about scientists who believed certain things. Scientists who did their best at calculating the age of the Earth by, you know, the cooling of the core. And they came up with numbers like the age of the Earth is 130,000 years. Or how they believed that all the species that we see today always had been on Earth since the beginning. And it's just an eye-opener, because scientists were doing their best, but they had crackpot ideas too. I mean, that weren't substantiated. And so it gives you some perspective about how, you know, sometimes you're overconfident in the things you think you know, and how it's really hard work to get to the bottom of things. Figuring out the age of the Earth was one of the biggest challenges ever.
Yeah. Oh, sure. And there's still, you know, we've got the approximate age of the Earth, but there's still some standard of error around that age, right? You know, we don't have it nailed down 100% with absolutely no probability.
I think we're within
error.
A tenth or
we're
billion
close.
Years. It's 4.3, 4.4 billion years.
Yeah, we're close.
There. Yeah. Yeah. I wanted to go back to the introduction to This Week in Science that I read at the top of the show. And in there is a word that I had never heard of, epigenetics. I briefly looked it up and I was still confused. Can you tell me about the epigenetics, what it is, why you discuss it?
Yes. So have you heard of genetics?
Of course.
Okay. So genetics is the study of our genes, right? And our genes are held wrapped up in our DNA. And when our DNA gets unwrapped, there are cellular mechanisms that can get into the DNA that can find the genes and copy them and translate them into proteins. So there's a transcription and translation process, and that creates proteins that run our cells and keep everything working.
That much I know.
Okay, so that's the basics. Now, there are components called histones, and there are glycases, they're like basically sugars that are attached to our DNA. when it's in its chromosomal all wrapped up state. And the histones especially are these little balls, these little structures that the DNA wraps around very tightly, and they lock down segments of our DNA so that if they're wrapped around a histone, there is no chance of transcribing or translating that segment of DNA. So any genes that are in there kind of hidden. And there, this is one of the components of the field that's called epigenetics, or above the genes. The study of the things that control the expression of our DNA.
Does this cause, I'm just curious from my amateur standpoint, what is the effect here? Does that cause failure to replicate properly?
It's not failure to replicate properly, but some of the interesting aspects of epigenetics are that this is thought to be where you've got Darwinian evolution that acts on through natural selection on the genes. This is more akin to I'm completely blanking on his name now that I'm talking about it. Lamarckian evolution, which was the idea that things that happen to you during your lifetime, not just population level evolution effects, but that things that happen to you within your lifetime, like the food you eat or the sun that you get that affects you, that these things can have an effect on your DNA.
Can that be passed on? I read some tenuous studies about how some of those things can be passed on by the birth mother, for example, facility with language or memories.
Yeah, so there are some very interesting studies in plants and very small set of studies in humans. The studies in plants, I'll go to those first, suggest that, say, you have a group of plants and they go through a period of drought where there's not enough water. And so epigenetics, these histones and other factors that affect how the DNA gets expressed, kind of change the DNA and change the way that all the proteins are expressed and the way that the cells work to respond to the drought. Now, those plants go on to have another generation. They have their plant babies, right? The plant babies are not really affected by these epigenetic changes, but we have seen that the grandchildren plants, the babies of the babies, actually have changes to how they look and how they respond to stressors like drought in their environment that their parents didn't have. There's something that is passed along that affects the way that they grow and the way they behave in reaction to their environment.
Wow.
And this is what's considered an epigenetic effect. You go in and look at the genes. If you were to sequence the DNA of those grandchild plants would be the same as the DNA of their parents and the same as the DNA of their grandparents. It's these above the DNA factors that are changing and somehow getting passed along. And this is the big question about epigenetics is, since all we really know about are the chromosomes getting copied and passed along, how is it that what is the replication mechanism for these other aspects of genetic control?
Wow. You know, I was raised as a physicist, and I had a kind of a disdain for biology and phylum groups and all the, if it wasn't Maxwell's equations, I wasn't interested. But, you know, if I were a young scientist,
Maxwell.
this is very intriguing because the more we learn about biology, the more technical and the more intriguing it gets to, you know, analysis with simulations and computers and a physics kind of approach to the technical aspects of evolution that we didn't have 30, 40 years ago. I think that's fascinating.
Yeah. Oh, it's amazingly fascinating. And now there's another along this epigenetic field, we're finding that. So the big thing is we have, you know, our somatic genes, which are the genes that are in your body. And those are not the genes that go on to make offspring, right? So the genes that go on to make offspring come from the gametes, from your reproductive cells. right? Mm-hmm. And so the how do, say, the sun or your diet or whatever, I can understand how it affects the cells in your body as you're doing stuff and it helps you to respond to things well, but it's those reproductive cells. When do those change and how do those change?
Oh, you've
and
done
that's
it again.
The big question.
You've done it again. You've done it again. You made me want to become a biology scientist.
Yes.
Good. You're really good. You really tell us great story. You know what? I think it's time we took a break with that explanation. When we come back, I want to talk to you about some of the things that you've been discussing on This Week in Science lately. Some interesting tidbits and piecemeal items like the ecology of our kitchen and other things like that. Folks, we're going to take a short break for 60 seconds. We'll be right back. Stay with us.
Hello there, all you fabulous background mode listeners. I'm Kelly Gamont with the Mac Observer, and I just want to say a few words about how you can support all the things we do. If you're thinking about buying something from Apple, Amazon, or Mac Mall, just go to the Mac Observer's homepage where we have a section called Support TMO. Or you can just enter macobserver.com/Apple Store, all one word, and that will take you to our special page for Apple and our other affiliates. If you make a purchase from one of our partners this way, the Mac Observer receives a small compensation for sending business their direction. Pretty cool, right? And you don't pay a penny more. This small fee from our affiliates helps us continue to bring you TMO's daily news, reviews, tips, how-tos, and podcasts like this one. So the next time you're thinking about an online purchase, come to TMO's homepage and support the Mac Observer. Thanks. Back to you, John.
We're back. I'm chatting with science communicator Dr. Kiki Sanford. And Kiki, I've been looking at This Week in Science and some of the things that you've been discussing lately, and they're very interesting. And if it's okay with you, I'd like to kind of just walk through some of these topics that you've been discussing lately. How's that
sound? Absolutely. It sounds great.
One of them that caught my eye was something I saw on Twitter in an article, and I'm not surprised that you discussed it too. Dirty kitchens. What's all this about? Is this just super bugs in the drain, or is this something more?
Well, there were a couple of different stories that we discussed about dirty kitchens on Twist recently. One of them was a study where these researchers actually made a fake kitchen setup with, you know, how kitchen drains, there's like that U-trap.
Mm-hmm.
And so a drain goes down, but then it makes a U and kind of goes back up before it
this
bends again to go into the wall.
From backflowing, right?
Exactly. And so there's usually like a bit of water down there, and that stops the gases.
A petri dish.
Ah, that's exactly it. And they found that and this is important for hospitals, not so much, I mean, yes, for home kitchens, but for hospitals as well, that even though you're cleaning your sink and cleaning your kitchen, that those wet, warm, moist areas in our drains are breeding grounds for bacteria, and the bacteria can crawl back up and out of the drains.
Oh,
they
that's
create
scary.
A moving biofilm, and biofilms are very resilient to all sorts of efforts to clean them off and get rid of them. So yeah, scary bacteria can, like the thing from the swamp.
The blob coming out of your garbage disposal.
The blob, it'll come out.
What can we do? Do we have to run Clorox down our garbage disposal once a week? Or is there anything
we
can
bleach,
do?
Yeah, bleach is one of the best things. I mean, that's one of the big tools in the arsenal, is to just bleach it and clean it out. And and this is also good because there was another study looking at actual kitchens, going through people's houses to see where bacteria lived in their kitchens. And you would think that, you know, maybe the refrigerator door handle would be a dirty place, but it's not the dirtiest. The dirtiest is the area right around your sink. Right next to the sink is where the most amount of bacteria was found. And there's some bad bacteria that are found there. And people, it seemed, there are many people who don't really know how to handle food, and they don't understand refrigeration.
Mm.
And basically they were discovering that there are just a lot of people who, even though they have kitchens, don't understand really how to use them right.
We make the assumption that our countertop is not clean, and we always prepare food on cutting boards that we run through the dishwasher. And when the cutting board gets too cut up, there's crevices where something might stick, you know, then we throw the cutting board away and buy a new one.
That's great. That is a fantastic methodology for avoiding infection. Another way, like I was saying on Twist, whenever I handle raw meat, like chicken, I actually have a little box of latex gloves underneath my sink so that I don't actually ever touch the chicken with my hands, but I use the gloves to be able to handle the meat.
Because it could get in your fingernails and then infect the rest of the food you're preparing.
And then you take them off in such a way that you pull one glove inside out and then you pull the other glove into it. And so then you just throw them away and there's no bacteria on your hands. And, never wash your poultry. A lot of people get their chicken or their turkey and then they wash them.
Really?
Unless you're maybe, I guess, putting it in a bath of water gently and then taking and washing it that way.
Why?
But because if you are just allowing a faucet to pour water onto this poultry skin, which is probably covered in a whole bunch of bacteria that you're going to cook off. Yeah. The water can bounce off. It'll hit the surface and bounce off and could end up places other than just in your sink, which is an easy place to clean. So unless you're really planning on cleaning very well after you do something like this, just don't wash your chicken or there's no reason to wash it.
Folks, I bet you never thought about how science could play such an important role in your kitchen. This is awesome. This is awesome.
Yeah, and make sure your refrigerator is around 38 degrees.
Keeping a thermometer in your refrigerator is a good idea. Yeah.
Yeah, you don't want a warm refrigerator. That allows bacterial growth.
All right, let's move on.
Okay.
So the next one that was interesting to me was something you're very familiar with, and that is how brain size being critical to birds, the first order. And when I saw that, I thought, well, you know, ostriches are a lot bigger than parrots, but parrots seem so much smarter than ostriches. Tell me about brain size.
Yeah, so there, across the board, not just in birds, there is a general relationship between brain size and body size. It takes more brain to control bigger body, right? You've got more proprioception or the sense of your body.
More sensors, more cells.
More sensors. Everything is just more. Right. So the bigger the body, the bigger the brain. And so that is a general relationship across the board. However, there is a question specifically coming from species that are really intelligent and social, like parrots and the corvids, like crows and jays, and from humans even, who have our language abilities. And where did these things come from? What was the basis of this? Did these abilities come first, or was it the brain material that came first? And so a recent study that we talked about did a huge analysis of like 20 different families of birds, comparing their brain size and their cognitive abilities. And what it discovered is basically you have to have the brain mass before the brain can start transferring it or taking some of that material and putting it to more specialized use.
Mm.
So you can't have an amazing language or vocal center if you don't already have a pretty big area devoted to articulation of the lips and the jaw and the tongue.
Are we harking back to epigenetics here?
There may have been something related to that. Yeah. Yes.
Interesting. So what's the smartest bird?
Oh, gosh. It depends. I mean, we're going to get in a conversation about what is intelligence and how do you define smart.
Here's so many great stories about parrots, you know, where the police arrive and the parrot's sitting around in the cage squawking, you know, like, you know, the dad did it, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I would say there is a lot of evidence that, like, the African gray parrot is incredibly intelligent in its language abilities. We find that the smarter, quote unquote, smarter birds, I'm saying that with quotes because it's like my little caveat, that the smarter birds are more playful, that there's usually a very large component of sociality to their behavior.
Does that mean we shouldn't keep parrots in a cage by themselves?
Yeah, no, people wonder all the time, why is my parrot pulling all of its feathers out? Yeah. Because you've stuck it alone in a cage. Maybe you associate with it like once a day for a little while. Your parrot has a stereotyped psychological disorder because you've basically put it in an isolation chamber. That is not parrot behavior. That's not what parrots are social. They live in flocks. They interact with other birds. And so you really have to know that you're going to be able to interact with your bird.
Interesting.
Give it the cognitive input, the stimulation that it needs, so it doesn't get crazy and start pulling its own feathers out.
Right.
I mean, and it's not enough just to put toys in the cage. I mean, that's stimulation, but they need social stimulation.
You need something that would be kind of considered creepy, a sort of a giant room in a terrarium where you have flocks of birds
and families and perches
and so on. As you walk into the room, you're being dive bombed and you have this squawking community of very happy parrots.
That sounds like heaven to me.
I don't think many people could deal with that, nor could their guests. All right, so moving on to the next topic. You talked on This Week in Science about how wine may be protecting your brain. Tell me about that.
Oh, yeah. Now, this study, it was related to genetics, but also bacteria in your gut. And people who had certain bacterial populations in their guts were more likely to have protective effects in their brain, so neuroprotective effects in their brain when they drank wine. And so we talk a lot on the show about this gut-brain connection, and there's more and more evidence coming out that, I mean, our gut itself is like a second brain because it's so full of neurons. I mean, it is in the number of neurons that are in your body, it is second to the brain, right?
I didn't know that. Wow.
Yes. And then we've got the microbiome. And so your gut is the place where your body, at the level of the neuron, is interacting at the neuronal receptor is interacting with microbes. So the microbes are affecting the cells in the gut. They're affecting the way that we intake our nutritional elements. They're affecting the inflammation in our gut. There was a study we talked about just last night on the show where researchers have found that microbes actually hone in on this one particular receptor. And when they attach to it, they can turn it off. And when they turn it off, that increases inflammation in the gut. And that's potentially related to diseases like IBS and Crohn's disease.
Irritable bowel syndrome.
Yes. Yeah.
Does it do any good to take a probiotic? Because these are for sale in every store.
This is one of the areas where it's still super questionable. It's not bad for you to take probiotics, but the evidence is not yet in as to really what they do, right? We don't have the studies that really prove. I mean, in science, you don't prove, you only disprove, but we don't have enough studies to actually say, yes, probiotics, everyone should be taking them. But we do know there seem to be some good bacteria in things like yogurt that if you're doing a fermented yogurt that has bacteria in it, you're probably going to get some good bacteria in there.
I read in a magazine that the amount of bacteria in a cup full of yogurt is negligible for financial reasons. Is that...
I haven't read that. I don't know. Right. I don't know. But the one aspect that people don't think about very often, it's like, oh, I'll take a pill, it's a probiotic, and everything will be fine. But if you're not eating the correct diet, if you're not getting what are called prebiotics, which are nutritional elements that will help to support healthy biotic environments, microbial environments in the gut, then those probiotics aren't really going to help.
Okay.
Okay. So you need to have a diet that has a lot of fiber in it. There are a lot of fermented foods. There are a lot of things that can be very helpful. So you have to balance it.
Fiber is good for another reason. It slows down the absorption of sugar into your system, so you don't overload your pancreas and get diabetes.
This all works hand in hand. Yes. I tell you.
Watch that diet, folks. All right, we have time for one more subject.
Okay.
One of my favorites, and one of your favorites too, robots.
Yeah.
How are you thinking?
It.
You know, there's a new robot called Buddy that I'm trying to get one for review, and then there's the well-known Pepper. So we're seeing stories about these little friendly white plastic robots that are going to be running around with our kids, and how that's going to evolve, and how robots are going to get stronger, maybe become physical threats, maybe become artificial intelligent agents that influence us unduly. Mm-hmm. All the things about robots. And then there's the business of, you know, should robots be regulated? Should there be programming standards? Should there be like an underwriter's lab for the safety of robots? What about a robot that you order from Japan or from China? Mm-hmm. You know, it crosses country lines and maybe doesn't have the same socioethics programmed into it. All these issues about robots. World domination, the end of society when robots take over. You know, are we unnecessarily concerned? Are we sort of reacting to science fiction specters? How are you feeling about corporate approach to the handling of these robots?
Well, I think both those questions, are we overreacting? Maybe. I don't know. But at the same time, should there also be regulation? Yes, there absolutely should. Science fiction is based in science fact, and we do know that we can follow the trend lines of technological advancement, and there is very good reason to believe that with increases in processing power and memory ability, and also as we increase artificial intelligence capabilities and learning in artificially intelligent machines, then this is going to be something we're going to be up against. We want bots that we can work with. We want them to have some kind of an equivalent intelligence so that they can understand our needs and help us, right? So that's where things are being developed. But if they have an equivalent intelligence, then there is the question of if they're connected to the internet, if they can learn, if they can make their own choices, what is that going to lead to? And we don't know. Yeah. It is a big gray box. And so as a result, I think, as in everything that we don't know how it's going to really affect society down the road, we need to have caution in our approach. And so I think the technologists who are rallying together and saying we need to be worried about this, I think we should listen to them, and I think there should be an international body to regulate the advancement of robotics.
I think so
and
too.
Artificial intelligence.
Because there's a political climate in Washington right now that says overregulation reduces competition and innovation, and so we should be hands off. in order to let these companies prosper and develop new technologies. But in that one case, that could be a dangerous approach, I think.
It could be a very dangerous approach. And, you know, it is an easy thought experiment to imagine a simple AI that in laboratory tests is doing great in human type learning experiments, right? And then somebody decides to attach that AI to the internet and allow them to learn. And what are the instructions? A bot is no better than its initial instructions. But how do we know the completely eventual ramifications of those instructions?
We can't even understand what's happening in our Mac OS with 50 million right. lines of code. It's so opaque right? to us. Error message number, minus 6. What is going on?
Yeah,
just think how hard it'll be to audit and understand the thought processes of AI agents. And
exactly.
We may ask them about why they came to the conclusions that they did and to explain to us their reasoning. They might lie.
Exactly. Just like my child, when I ask him something and he says, no, I didn't eat the cookie.
Yeah.
Like, I know you ate the cookie. Why are you lying to me? Something in his head told him he needed to lie to me. Even though he knows I know.
All right. Well, we're about out of time.
That's too bad.
You know, you're going to have to become a regular. I just have so much fun chatting with you.
Yeah, it's wonderful. I love having these conversations with you, too. It's very fun.
One final question.
All right.
How can the listeners better support Research in Science? Is there an organization that is publicly funded that they would best, where their money would be best funded if the government were lacking? Or is it better to just subscribe to the science magazines like Discover and Scientific American and support them to make sure they stay in print? Besides listening to This Week in Science, is there anything the listeners can do to sort of, use their wallet to help promote science and support it and fund it?
Absolutely. One of the big things that you can do is vote for representatives in our government, local and at the national level, who support government funding of science research and who support using science to inform good governmental policy. That's number one, one of the best and easiest things that you can do. Number two is magazines like Discover and Scientific American. It's like subscribing to the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal for quality reporting. If you want to see these outlets remain, we need to put our money where our eyeballs are. And then third, in the United States, there is a nonprofit organization called the American Association for the Advancement of Science. It is the organization that that awarded me the Mass Media Fellowship, where I was able to go and be embedded in New York City at WNBC to learn how to communicate science to a TV audience. They embed a bunch of people, scientists, every summer as part of an educational process to teach scientists how to communicate better with the public and how the media works.
Yeah, Jennifer Ouellette mentioned that. Yeah.
Yeah. So the AAAS, American Association for the Advancement of Science, is a wonderful place to support if you are interested in supporting science and good science communication to the people. And another organization is the National Academies of Science.
All right, cool. Well, we have run over time, but it was well worth it. I want to thank you so much for joining me on the show. This has been, again, fascinating, fascinating stuff. You have the ability to excite me and make me want to explore just everything you've talked about. I mean, you make it sound.
Oh, yay!
I wish I were younger and could, branch out and do some of these things as research. So this has been very cool. So
yeah, there are some great books out, popular science books on the topic of epigenetics and others that, and bird brains. There are some good books on bird brains as well.
So. Okay, so you send me some info. We'll put them in the show notes.
All right. Thank you so much.
Thank you for being on the show. And listeners, I hope you enjoyed this show. We always appreciate it when you come by. Thanks for being a listener of Background Mode. We'll see you next week.